I figure every week I pretend like I'm a rap, so this week I drop a couple bars so they know what it is. You know what I'm saying? Yo, we get down.
Hey, if you keep going, eventually we're going to have a verse, and there it is.
I know.
Like I say, the Freedom Train is sponsored by PAX, Inc. And remember, PAX, Inc. is a black advocacy organization aimed at developing the black community to its maximum potential through a focus on education and economics with the traits of hard work, honesty, and integrity. And for more information about PAX, Inc., and remember, that's PACTSINC, make sure you visit www.paxinc.org. That's PACTSINC.org. And make sure you visit our Freedom Train website at www.freedomtrainradio.com to learn more about us and hear the playback of your favorite shows like this one, because you know this one's going to be one of your favorite shows. And you can also subscribe to the Freedom Train podcast on iTunes and Google Play Store. So we done stepped our game up a little bit, Pat. We ain't all the way ashy no more. You know what I'm saying?
Nah, we got a little bit of lotion. We got a little
bit. You know what I'm saying? A little Crisco, a little shea butter, whatever we can find. So
who we got?
Man, look. We got the incredible, the world-renowned, the award-winning author, Stephen Dunn, the author of Potted Meat. What's going on, Steve?
Oh, man, nothing. Thank y'all for having me. I just want to say, first off, I appreciate what y'all do, having real conversations about education and economics. I follow all the posts. I spread it as far as I can and let everybody know to subscribe. So, yeah, I'm really digging it. I love it. I think it's important work, so I appreciate it. And thanks for having me.
Man, no problem, man. We appreciate you and everything you do. And our studio audience want to show you some love because they love you too. You know what I'm saying?
Thank you.
Yes, sir. So before we jump all the way in the interview, can you give us a little background information about you? And then, you know, we're going to go ahead and kick the interview off.
I grew up born and raised in a little southern town in West Virginia, and I just joined the Navy by default because I figured that was the best way for me to get out of there, and it was something I used to paint before, and then something told me I should be writing because my wife called me out on my paintings and asked me why I had a lot of words on them, and I was like, yeah, I think I should be a writer, and then I start taking it seriously, and there it is. I got out of the Navy and I went to University of Denver and took English there and learned a whole bunch about writing and just published this book just now.
Okay. That's what's up, man. And if you didn't hear me the first time, the name of his book is Potted Meat, a novel by Stephen Dunn. And it's actually available on your website, correct?
Yes, it's on my website. It just hit Amazon and small press distribution. And
okay.
My publisher is selling it as well.
Okay. And his website is stephendunn.com. And make sure you go check it out there. Go to amazon.com. Get your copy of Potted Meat. Now, before we get into the interview, I got to say this because, you know, as we were speaking earlier, I'm from a town that has a lot of different cultural mixes, but country is one of the things, and I'm used to potted meat, and around here they call it souse, and you know, either that or they have the little spam or the little fake spam, or if you get the little commodities, you know, the commodities that come with it, just say meat on the can and stuff like that. So I'm interested to learn about your book because I'm familiar with potted meat, so.
Yeah, I think first off, it was a symbol for poverty and country stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, sorry about that. So but more, you know, like I was interested in the presentation of potted meat, how, you know, it's presented as something that will sustain you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they got the fancy sandwich on the cover, on the label. And then when you read the ingredients, there's something different. So
right.
That was part of me, you know, part of the concept of this book is really looking into the ingredients of a place, of people's lives, and just seeing, like, are these things sustainable as it presents itself?
Okay. All right, Pat, you know how we do this. You got the first question. Go ahead and do your thing, man.
So, you moved around a lot. I'm guessing you were born and raised in West Virginia, 10 years in the Navy, and now you're in Denver, Colorado. So, in all that traveling, what were some of the things that inspired you, some of the different cultural environments that had an effect on your writing and things like, tell us how being around the country has had an effect on Stephen Dunn.
Well, it was all like after being in West Virginia for so long and then being exposed to different states and cultures and countries, there's always that reflection about, man, I grew up this way and this is what I've seen. And there's always a comparison, especially even when I had kids, that was one of the big comparisons. So that was like an in-home comparison. But, I lived in Hawaii for most of my adult life, and then, you know, the same things. We see Hawaii as, like, paradise,
mm-hmm.
all of this beautifulness. And when you get there, yes, there are those aspects, but it's quite different. Like, there are a lot of homeless people in Hawaii. And then so I start seeing the same aspects of where I grew up. So people think everybody in the country is nice. It's such a wonderful place. But when you look below the surface, there are other things going on at play. So I think seeing a lot of that in Hawaii definitely informed me wanting to get back to write this book.
Okay.
How long have you been? I'm sorry, Joe.
No, go ahead. Ask a question. Go ahead.
How long have you been working on this book?
I worked on it for about 3 years. So from about 2011 to 2014. Then, of course, it takes a while to find somebody to publish it. And then after that, it takes a while for it to get out into the world. So,
okay.
Yeah. So 3 years it took me to write it. But if I count the time that I started writing and failed at it, I want to say maybe 5 or 6 years.
Okay. So it was a project that basically went through its maturation process and came out. Because, I mean, you are everywhere with your book. I was going through your website, and I was just looking at your upcoming events and all the things. And I was like, wow, man. You are literally everywhere, so congratulations, man.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. So we talked about it a bit, but why did you come up like why did you say, okay, potted meat is the title of my book? That's what I'm going with. Like, why did you come up with that? And did you have any other titles that you may have wanted to go with, but potted meat was just the one that kind of stood out to you?
Yeah, when I was writing it, so I wrote it in these little vignettes, you know, these little snippets and fragments of stuff. And so I was writing it, and I knew, I was like, man, I think I got a book here. So I'm writing it,
mm-hmm.
and then just constantly thinking about West Virginia, and I thought that title matched the vignettes that I had, because, like, everything
mm-hmm.
is compressed and pounded and mixed up with each other. So yeah,
okay.
So that was kind of the idea. And then I also had the title. I started it out, it was like moonshine and potted meat. Moonshine and I was thinking of symbols. And then potted meat just fit more. And I was like, I figure I'll make sure I mention the moonshine quite a bit in the book. You know?
Right. Yes sir. Now yeah, that's funny because that actually goes with some of the stereotypes of those parts, you know, those hills, the Hatfields and McCoys and all those mountains
yeah.
and the moonshine and stuff. So, okay, that's funny.
So what's potted meat about?
Oh, man, that is such a hard question. for me, you know, like, aside from the stuff on the back of the book, like, follows a young man, I mean, a young boy going through adolescence, but for me, it's about being naked and being vulnerable and saying the things that are hard to say and just accepting that. And yeah, I think that's what it's about for me, just really being open about it and saying the impossible. Like, how do you say that?
Okay. And so when you, and are you being more vulnerable about your personal story or things that you've experienced or in other people's experiences as well?
Both, yeah. A lot of it's both. A lot of it is drawn from personal experience, but I don't want to call it a memoir.
Okay.
Or, you know, autobiography or any of that, because I don't want to tie it too much to myself, because I think, and I could be wrong, I think it may not mean as much to other people if it's completely tied to me.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Okay.
And another thing, like, a lot of families have their family secrets, for better or worse, most of the times for worse.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like an expose on my family, but it's just a way for me to explore how to talk about the tough things that families don't talk about.
Okay.
Okay.
And so, I want to ask this, and it's kind of off of our beaten path, but can you kind of go into, I guess, the culture of the portion of West Virginia that you grew up in, and what impact did that culture specifically have on your writing?
Okay. Yeah, so I think I was talked about this before, and I think the book is speaking from being like levels of disappearance.
Mm-hmm.
So I think West Virginia is a state that has disappeared from the nation. Usually if I tell people I'm from West Virginia, they say, oh, I've been to Richmond before. And I'm like, that's a different state. You know,
wow.
Nothing to do with that. You know, it is.
Wow.
So, yeah, I think we're forgotten about it, you know, in nationwide. And then West Virginia has the lowest education system. It competes with Mississippi and Alabama, of course. And then you also get to the race factor, too, where, you know, black people are at a disadvantage, even more in this disadvantaged state, town, mm-hmm. and all of that. So I think that's what it is learning how to speak or trying to speak from all of these levels of disappearance.
Okay. Okay. So you're basically a voice for your section of West Virginia.
Yeah, I'm hesitant to say that because even in my section of West Virginia, there are lots of different voices that I value just as much. So
okay.
I would say it's one voice, and I think that's the problem is we need to value other voices as well. So I don't want to speak for the whole town or the whole state. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
And like another big part of the culture for me is like I don't want to say West Virginia is behind the times, like we're backwards, but you know, we're listening to the music in the 70s, like it just came out, you know, in the 80s. Late 80s, like it just came out, you know. So all my uncles and a lot of family members, we're still speaking 70s slang and all of that. So for me, like, that's a huge part of the culture. And then we get the rap from New York and from down south. You know, it's in a pretty neutral area geographically, so
right.
We're not one way. We're not like straight Southern. We only listen to Master P. You know, we're like Master P, Nas, Wu-Tang, Outkast.
Mm-hmm.
We're kind of lucky in that sense that we get to draw from everywhere.
Okay. That's cool. Well,
you know, 70s slang is making a comeback, though, so.
It is, yeah. I was talking to my daughter about that.
Say, Jack.
He was like, you've been calling me Jive Turkey all my life, and I heard somebody say that the other day.
Right.
Yeah. See? It's not going to come back. I call my kids Jive Turkeys, too.
Yep.
They
I think Pat messaged me. It was like, what's up, bro, Ham? I was like, oh, man, that's what I
said. Yeah. Shoot. They made the mistake of calling my wife a Jive Turkey. That didn't go over so well.
Yeah.
But, hey, so you talked about earlier about finding a publisher. What was that process like, and why did you choose to go with a publisher instead of going the self-publishing route?
Instead of self-publishing?
Yes.
Because I like the idea of community building and building connections. You know, I mean, not in a networking business sense, but in a sincere way. And there are other writers writing, and they're, you know, they have access to different communities. So that's why I chose to find a publisher. And my process, it was good. I had a teacher told me that when you try to publish, you should try to do it from a place of abundance rather than desperation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kept that in mind. I looked at places and say, what books have I read? I looked at my bookshelf. You know, it's like, where am I reading? Because that stuff influences my writing too. So I just looked at places that I really liked and wanted published. And the publisher who picked me up, I had been reading their books for 4 years, and I was like, oh, man, this is a long shot for me trying to get, you know, get on this press. And I was just really happy when he picked me. And a lot of it is disheartening, too, trying to publish as a black person, I feel, because we all know black people aren't represented well in the publishing world, you know,
right.
Small presses or major presses. And so I look at different presses, and I see nothing but white authors on there. And I'm like, oh, man, are they really going to understand or, you know, really value what I have to say? And that's a real fear. It could be wrong sometimes, and I may be right. But, yeah, it's always been a concern of mine to look at that.
Okay. So do you feel like your publishing company value you as a black writer?
Yeah, I think they do. Yeah, they value me first as a writer and a person, you know, and I'm black, so that is mm-hmm. tied to it. But
right.
Yeah, my he read it. He was like, I absolutely love this story. You know, okay. The book, it hits on a lot of levels, you know, and they, I think they value other writers. They publish a lot of women and, you know, like other minorities and stuff too. So I think they are aware of what's going on in the publishing world, and they take an active approach to look at, like, marginalized stories and books and non-traditional things. So.
Okay. So, you have earned several awards, like we mentioned earlier, and you've been nominated for various awards as well. Last year, 2015, you were the co-winner of the I don't think I'm saying it right, but the Tarpaulin Sky Book Prize. So can
yeah,
you give
that's,
us a,
yeah, that's my publisher, yeah.
Okay, so can you give us a little more background information about how you were able to win this award and tell us about some of the other awards that you've either won or been nominated for?
Okay, so the book prize was that everybody submits, you know, that my publisher was like, hey, we're open to read books. You know, whoever we pick wins this prize, and the prize is publishing. And so it was enough. I just submitted and, you know, waited a few months, and he contacted me. And there were four other authors that won the prize also, and they're all really great too. And yeah, so that was the first prize, was the book being published.
Okay.
Sorry. And then my publisher nominated me for a Grantus Best Young American Novelist, which is through a University of Cambridge in England.
Okay.
And he's also nominated me for the Penn American Award for Debut Fiction. So yeah, I haven't heard back, though, because the books come out in 2016. So 2017 is when they will announce it.
Okay, man. So basically, is this some of the success that you were dreaming about, imagining, or is this things that happened that you are like, wow, I wasn't even expecting this?
Yeah, I totally wasn't expecting the international attention and the awards or any of that. Like, I dreamed about being published one day by a good press that I loved, and that happened, mm-hmm. so I was really happy with that, first off.
Right.
Yeah, my other success came from my friends and I talk about this. We're like, oh, would black people read this book? Or, you know, not that we're trying to pander to anybody, but just writing what's true to us. But we think right. about it. You know, like we use Chris Rock, for example, like in D-Ray or Cat Williams. You know, like, oh, man, white people and black people love Chris Rock. What is he doing? You know,
mm-hmm.
like, what's going on here? And it's interesting because we are in this culture, but... Yeah, for me, like, the main success for me is people to read it and connect with it, whoever they are. And I have been really lucky that a lot of people from West Virginia have been reading the book, and they call me and like, wow, you know, like, I never knew how to talk about this stuff, and now I kind of have a way to talk about these things now, and, you know, abuse and all types of things. So it's, yeah, that's really happy. I'm just so thankful for all of that. And that's why I, like, figured the real success is there. I'm happy about mm-hmm. the other stuff, but that's the real success.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, Another thing that's impressive is that, you know, you mentioned earlier that you started out as a painter, and your wife redirected you to writing because your painting had words in them, a lot of words, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
So, explain to people, or if you will, just give what it means to, because a lot of people start out with these dreams of what they're going to do and how they're going to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of them kind of give up on those dreams after the first roadblock, more give up after the second roadblock. You know, then for others, it doesn't, it's just not happening fast enough. You know, what really kept you going while you were going through this process of fulfilling your dream to become a published author?
I think what kept me going is, one, like a supportive community of folks that that always, you know, encouraged me and everything. But the big thing was my intention behind doing it. You know, I was like, I feel like this is something I have to do and I need to do and I want to do. So that's one of the big things. And then also just being inspired by other people. I see, you know, like, man, Nas put out this album, you know, mm-hmm. from the projects. It's not writing, but it's the same. It's creating, you know.
Right.
It's doing something. And, you know, I see, oh, Amiri Baraka. And I have all these examples of people like me who society tells can't do anything, but these people do it. It is wonderful to have these examples and people that don't ask permission from anybody to do their stuff, they do it. And it's just, I feel like that's a necessary thing to do. Nobody gives you permission, so.
That's true. That's true. I mean, it's, to me, it's about, you know, finding your lane, staying in your lane and being the best that you can be and evolving as much as you can in your lane. And,
yeah.
And the inspiration that you, because it's funny, it's always funny, you find inspiration from the most peculiar places. So,
yeah.
You know, I was, and as I was looking through your website, I saw that Illmatic, particularly Illmatic and the Quemini were two of the albums that influenced you. And it's cool because, like you mentioned earlier, you grew up in a place where you were influenced by a lot of different aspects of hip-hop, because those two albums also shaped. Well, we're in the South, so we're 4 hours away from Atlanta. So anything Outkast is greater than Jay-Z down here. Like, you can't even, if you come down here, you know, come down here and talk about Jay-Z the greatest, and you're gonna get karate chopped or something, you know.
Yeah.
But we respect that Illmatic though.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But also looking at your other influences, the other writers, and. It's cool to see that you are not boxed in as an artist, as a creator. You're not boxed in, and you allow yourself to be influenced by many, many different things, and then you put your own spin on it and give the world something beautiful. So that's cool,
oh,
man.
Oh, appreciate it, man. That's, yeah, cool. I think just being open to, you know, any aspect of, yeah, I love Japanese flower arranging, you know, and I'm totally influenced by that. The minimalism, how they use space and how they consider the space, you know, that's a huge influence to me too. But yeah, there's stuff everywhere, man. It's wonderful.
Right.
I like Japanese anime.
Oh, well, yeah, me too, man. Yes.
See? Ah, Joe, you don't even know, yes, what sir. That is, do you?
Man, you
what
know
is that?
I do. You know I do.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I'm going to ask my daughter. She's a pro in that field.
Yeah. Like, I if you ask me about any of the movies or the shows, I can't tell you that. But, you know, outside of Dragon Ball Z. So.
Oh, man. Anime is so much bigger than Dragon Ball Z, bro. Dragon Ball Z is a good one, though.
See? Hey, man.
Afro Samurai. Yeah.
There you go.
Right,
there you go.
Right. Afro Samurai. Like, I'm finna, you know what? I ain't thought about that movie in at least a year. I'm fixing to go check out the movie and the episode.
Well, yeah. Let me ask this. So would the Black Dynamite cartoon fit in that category?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
So does Boondocks, too. Like, that's totally influenced by Japanese anime, man. But it's still black as hell, and I love it.
Right. Right.
I love the Black Dynamite movie.
Yes. Yeah. Yes,
So Steven, what's your favorite anime?
My favorite anime?
Uh-huh.
I like Hayao Miyazaki. So, man, all Spirited Away and My Neighbor Totoro, those are some of my favorites.
I never heard either one of those.
Oh, man, yeah. The dude, he has like 70 movies out, man.
That's cool. So let me ask this question. You've been featured in a number of different editorials and publications, including the Columbia Journal and the Granter Magazine. So what does it mean to you as a writer and as a man to know that you are successful because you followed your dreams?
That's a tough one. Because I think the way we talk about success is like always a validation. So, yeah, like Columbia Journal and Granter, like they're, you know, primarily white magazines from white colleges, and those are great. But, you know, I think that's why, and I try to validate other writers, like, separate of those publications, you know, like, are you really doing the work with integrity, and are you doing what you need to do with care and learning all you can? So I validate those ways. So I would feel like, for me, that process is a form of success. And these other things are cherries on the top, and they're great, but I wouldn't use that as a measuring stick. You know, it's people's taste. You know, I've been rejected plenty of places also, so they didn't like my stuff. So.
Right.
I like that.
Because that's something me and Pat talk about all the time is we don't have to be, you know, validated by white America for us to really understand what success is and that we are successful. Because,
exactly.
You know, you being able to make a living off of what you enjoy doing, in a sense, well, hell, that is success.
Yeah.
And you can define your success however you want to define your success. And if, like you said, if none of these magazines ever contacted you, but you're still enjoying what you're doing and you'll be able to make a difference, then you're successful.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I think about that a lot, just how, like, that validation has to come from elsewhere. Even when people ask me what I read, I was like, I read Nas, I read Outkast. To me, that's just as valid as an education as
it is.
An institution. You know, it may not be recognized as such, but I think we should value it as such.
You just gave me an idea, the Freedom Train Award Show.
There you go. We're
going to start validating our own people. How about that, Joe?
Hey, man, you know I'm down.
Hey, that's a good idea.
I'm down, man, because we have to, like Dick Gregory talks about all the time, we have to validate ourselves. We have to acknowledge each other. And you know, part and reason, that's part of the reason why we started this show, because Pat and I saw a lack of, you know, just love for each other as far as people who are out trying to make a difference, trying to make a living, trying to create empires. Because we always, our mindset is always in competition mode, and I hate that. And it could be more of complementing each other rather than competing with each other all the time.
Yeah, like, look what's happening now. You guys made a radio station and are talking to me in this moment, you know, live.
Right.
That's beautiful. That didn't have to come from a validation from somebody else. You saw a need and a want, and you did it. And it's just great. It makes me excited.
Yes, sir.
Because I just want to be a success. I like it. All right.
You crazy, man.
Yeah, I like that idea, because, you know, we're always talking about the fact that success isn't a destination, it's a journey. And when you're being validated, a lot of the times they're just looking at your destinations, where you've gone, where you landed, blah, blah, blah. And very seldom are people recognized for all the work that went into, even if it was just taking one step. You know, there's still, for some people, taking that one step took a tremendous amount of work. And in all of that work is the success itself.
Right.
They never feel successful because instead of looking at the process and the progress and all the work they've done, you know, they're counting how many steps they've taken.
Yeah,
so that's true.
If that makes sense. I don't think that makes sense.
I understand what you're saying. Yeah, I get it.
All right. Anyway, that's why we're interviewing you when I'm supposed to be asking questions and not talking. All right.
No. It's a conversation, man.
But you're crazy.
I don't feel like that, man. I feel like I just confused my damn self.
Hey, man, you put the bread on top of the peanut butter and you got a sandwich. There you go. That's all you need to know.
So I know I was reading a little bit about the publisher that published your book, and I know they tend to publish, as you said, kind of out-of-the-box type books or authors and things like that. And I know you being an English major, you had to read a lot of traditional things and stuff like that. How did you maintain your own personal unique style in a college atmosphere that was more than likely, and matter of fact, let me start there. Was your college atmosphere conducive to you maintaining your own personal style?
And my school was great. all the teachers and everything. Yeah, like we rarely read traditional books. They're out there. I mean, who hasn't read them? So they did a good job of introducing us to non-traditional narratives and, you know, and all of that. And it's just like, yeah, this is where it's at, you know.
Okay. So they fostered your unique creativity.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, like, I didn't have that. Well, I probably had it, but, you know, growing up, you think, like, this is a novel. This is what a book's supposed to look like. And
right.
If I want to penetrate this, I need to write like that. And I was at that point before until I started seeing a lot of other different things. I'm like, wow, you know, like, these people are doing it. It's totally fine to do.
So how would you describe your writing style?
Oh, man, that's a really good question. I want to say it's minimalist. I go with that one just as a proxy right now. So it is minimalist because I want to get all the unnecessary stuff out of the way in order to get to the heart of the thing. So that's kind of what I strive for there.
Okay.
Now, I guess your process, because in my mind, a part of creative writing is, first of all, finding a process that is best for you. So,
yeah.
for young up-and-coming authors, and like I have a young man in mind, what advice would you give for these young authors to be able to help them be able to I guess you could say, create that space around them and then be able to put that pen to paper and kind of just let it flow. What kind of, and I'm trying my best to describe it as a writer, but what advice would you give to young writers to be able to help them find themselves and find that lane and kind of stay in that lane and be able to express themselves the way that they want to?
Yeah, I think it takes a hard look at yourself and it's like some honesty. Like, you can't bullshit yourself. The paper will let you know. And I think it takes a real honesty with yourself, first of all, to say, why am I doing this? What do I want to do? And that's my first thing. And you hear the other, like, the more technical stuff, like write every day, blah, 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 2,000 words. That's not the best route for me.
Mm-hmm.
But it may work for some people, so I really wouldn't give that advice. But I put it out there as an alternate of, like, you don't have to do that, I don't think, right every day and all of that. So.
Right.
But you do have to do it a lot, though. I also suggest, like, going to readings and seeing what other people are writing, being critical, like, what would I do differently? What do I like from that? You know, it's kind of the same with anything. You know, you're a chef. You're going to go to some restaurants and eat some food. You know?
Right.
You know what? I like that, though, because I remember my first book. I had listened to a bunch of people give advice on what to do, and they were all giving the same advice, write every day, write every day, write every day. So I wrote every day, and I realized after about 6 months of writing every day that my writing wasn't getting any better just by me writing every day.
Yeah.
So I can appreciate you giving other suggestions that might work, because that one in particular, like, it just, essentially, it's like telling somebody, you know, if you practice every day, you'll get better. Well, if you practice every day, you'll get better at what you're practicing. That's not necessarily saying that you're getting better. That just means that what you're doing repeatedly is becoming more ingrained and becoming more habitual. So,
yeah, it's not intentional practice, you know. It's like,
right.
I'm just going through these motions. And I think also not writing every day, you leave room for stuff to come into your writing, some accidents, some unexpected influences and everything.
Right. See, now that's what I'm talking about, because right now I'm struggling with the fact that I wrote every day and I wasn't very good at grammar. So now I have some grammatical errors that I have to fight with because they're ingrained in my writing.
Yep, I recognize some of those. Yeah.
He's saying that because he read some of my stuff on a project I'm working on. So, anyways.
but you both are right, because a lot of times when people, especially now, because you have access to so much information, and so people would just fall in line without question, you know, without thinking outside the box. Hey, well, I guess this is just what I'm supposed to do. And it's like, it's not, you know, it's good. It's a good thing to read, but it's also good to get out and, like you say, socialize, meet other writers, and kind of pick up tips from other people who are doing what you're doing, so you can grow.
Yeah, nice. And I think a lot of that advice is coming from very privileged places too. Like, people like, get out and see the world, write every day. Like, if you're working all types of crazy hours to feed your family, you want to be a writer. That's just not going to happen. So you need to find what works for you, you know, in your situation. And I think that's missing. It should be fluid about how you practice and how you write.
Right. And always remember, folks, when professionals practice, they have a coach with them.
Yes, coaching is important.
Right. Yeah, they're trying to do it by yourself. Because what are you teaching yourself? How are you reinforcing that with yourself if you don't know?
Because I didn't write my book by myself. I had my two good friends. You know, we met like every week for like 3 years, you know, constantly going over the stuff. They telling me what's up with it. So it was very much written, not alone. So yeah, this idea of like a solitary writer in his room, that may happen, but it didn't do that way for me. And my book probably wouldn't be as good if it weren't for those two people.
Right. So speaking of, you know, your book and your project, so we kind of want to know about other things you have going on. Do you have any previous books that you have that you've written and you want to publish, or you have published, and do you have any new upcoming projects?
The old books, I deleted them from my hard drive, and I'm done with them. I don't want it to weigh me down, but because I've probably taken everything I needed to learn from those books, and I moved on with them. But now I'm writing a book about the military now, and I'm really questioning this hero aspect and terrorism aspect of the military and some of the institutional problems that people like to say, that's a bad apple. We all know about the bad apple syndrome. It's just a way to keep deflecting the problems. So I'm really trying to look at people's direct experiences in the military, and also how it works institutional. Because I read a lot of critical things about the military, and I read a lot of stuff from the military. I read a lot of stuff from people in the military, and it seems like either one of those things are missing something. So the critical stuff is missing personal experience, and a lot of the personal experience is not being critical about those experiences. So I'm trying to blend the two and write like a fictional ethnography about the military.
Okay.
That is interesting because it piques my interest in a lot of different ways. Me being a vet myself, but also being someone who is not necessarily pro-military. And I know a lot of people are confused by that because it's rare that you meet a vet that would tell other people to look at other routes before you go into the, like, look at other things. Try to do something else first. And I'm not going to say, you know, you should be homeless out on the streets before you join the military. But, you know, that in my opinion, right, the way I feel right now and the way I felt especially after getting out with some of the experiences I dealt with, you know, I was like, well, you would need to be at that point, in my opinion, before you join, especially with the state of the country right now, the way the country is reacting to black people and all of the other things that are going on right now. It's just hard. It's hard for me, and I realize that it's not coming from a very objective place. I realize that it's coming from a very negative and emotional place. So that book, with you trying to combine the critical thinking aspect along with some of the other aspects into an analysis of the military is something that I would definitely be interested in reading. Definitely.
Yeah, it's hard to do. Like you said, like sometimes I come from a negative and emotional place too, and I have to get out of the way, you know, like not let my stuff mess this thing up, you know. I mean, it influences what I choose to put in the book, of course. I'm not saying I'm totally objective, but it's there, you know. Like, I feel like a lot of people get a pass in the military. You're automatically a hero and a good person.
Right.
And that shows up in movies and literature and all of that. And I just don't want to take that route because I know some really terrible people in the military. I was probably a terrible person at some point in the military. You know, like, I'm not a hero. Not everybody that does this are heroes.
I think that's why your book, especially you write it, if you put it in such a way and it's so eloquent, people are going to be forced to read it. And I think that is something that needs to be said, because we do have this, it's almost like people are brainwashed into thinking, like you said, like every single person that comes into the military and comes out of the military is deserving of that hero's welcome. Like it's almost like saying every cop is good, or every doctor is good, or every and it's not that every teacher isn't good. So every teacher doesn't deserve to be praised, but the good ones do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think it's something larger to that. Like, we may blame it on individuals, but I think, like, especially in the military and with cops, I think there's a culture that sends a message that certain behavior is okay.
Right.
You know, it's like sexual harassment in the military, you know, was a huge problem. And people are like, oh, those are just bad enlisted folks that don't know how to act. But when you look at all the patterns, it's happening far and wide. It is an institutional problem.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But you're talking about culture, and that's the interesting thing is how little respect people actually give to culture. Like, how little respect they give to how your culture can influence your behavior, how it kind of guides you and your subconscious actions and all those other things. I mean, I was thinking about my time in base housing. It was like it was like almost normal for husbands to come home and beat up their wives.
Oh my God, yes.
It was normal. Right. It was something that you're not a hero for doing that, but you know, you have a rough day at the office, you come home, maybe your wife made your hot chocolate too hot and you pop it in the mouth real quick. You know, and but those types of things, like, you know, if base housing, especially where I was, it was like 60 years, 60 or 70 years behind the outside world in terms of culture and what was acceptable and what wasn't. But
yeah,
what you said about being a hero rings a bell too, because I knew a lot of very devious criminal type personnel that wore the uniform, and I'm sure when I first got in, I did some very assholish things to civilians as well. So I wasn't deserving of any hero's welcome when I went back home.
Yeah.
So it's something that's needed, but it's a conversation that you're seldom able to have because of how people are trained to feel about the military, about cops, about firefighters, teachers, you know,
yeah,
all of those people.
Yeah, and I think this book or novel is a good way to explore that. You know, I don't have to follow any rules about it, you know, and I don't care if it's not published by Granta or any big publisher. I was like, I need to do the work I feel like I need to do in
right.
this form. So, yeah.
But that's what being an artist is about, you know, that free expression to be able to write, especially things that need to be created. You being able to do what's in your heart and
yeah.
impact people on a positive level and not worry about what others say, what others think, and just do you. That's what real artistry is about.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot of backlash, you know, it's going to happen, you know.
But
I get the backlash with my current book that's out, and I understand it, and, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well,
it's necessary, though. Like, it's because I think when you hold people to a standard, like we say we hold the police officers and the military and all these other personnel, then, you know, that doesn't mean throwing praises on them regardless. That means when they live up to that standard, you shower them with the adulation they deserve. But when
yes.
they fall short of that standard, you know, you let them know that as well. You punish them accordingly. And even if the punishment has to be something extremely harsh, then, you know, that's kind of the negative to being in a position that's put on a pedestal. So instead of us just assuming that all military personnel are heroes and treating them accordingly, you know, we should look at the people that really are heroes and treat them accordingly. You should be getting a hero's welcome for even
yeah.
thinking about starting a discourse like that. You know
mm-hmm.
what I'm saying? Like, to even say, because you're putting yourself out there in a way that not a lot of people will realize, to even go out and say, I'm going to write a book that's going to be somewhere critical of our view on the military, even saying that sentence would be enough if you were a large enough personality to destroy you.
Yeah.
Right.
And people always think critical means negative, you know?
Right.
And that's the thing, you know, like, critical, I think maybe comes like you criticizing me, but, like, critical is just really taking a hard look at something, you know?
Right, I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's crazy. So, all right, let me ask this. 20 years from now. Well, let's say you get into a time machine. Me, you, and Pat right now, we get into a time machine. We go 20 years in the future.
I hope we drinking Wild Turkey.
Hey, man. Hey. Wild Turkey honey. Yes, sir. That Wild Turkey honey. Yes, sir. So what type of life, when we go into the future, what type of life is Stephen Dunn living, and what type of impact has his writing had on his readers?
Oh, man. Okay, yeah, I've thought about this a little bit. My lofty goal, with the book out now, I really hope, it's my wish that black families would look at, like, whooping their kids a lot more, like be more critical of that. So, you know what I'm saying? My book is solely responsible, and there are other people talking about it, but I wish that's one of my wishes for my writing, this current writing. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
You know, like, what is that? What impact does it have? Is this the best way to do things? And, you know.
So you're not a fan of spankings, huh?
I'm not, yeah. Oh. And I don't want, and I know usually when I say that, people have told me, so you don't want to discipline your kids, and I'm not saying that.
That's not what you're saying.
Yeah.
Like, people, it's so funny how people would take one small thing you say and then, like, run a 99-yard touchdown with it, and you're looking like,
yeah,
you're going the wrong way. Like, I didn't even say that. Like, are you serious?
Yeah.
Because I grew up the way me and my brother grew up. Let's say the first half of our life as young people living in our parents' house, you know, we got spankings because that's the culture that our parents come from. Our parents divorced, so we living with our mom. She still spanked us as well. Now, after she got into a car wreck and she could not physically do those things anymore because she was deemed as legally disabled, so she couldn't necessarily whoop us. So she found other means of punishment. And I tell people any day, I will, and the reason why I would say this is because just the way I grew up, and I wouldn't say this for anybody else because this is across the board. But for us, she found if you take away, if you tell me I can't go outside, that's like the worst thing ever. And you know, being able to take away outside, take away the video games, take away phone calls or girls, you can't talk, you can't do nothing with these girls, whatever. It's like, oh man, I'm really on punishment. And I'm saying that to say that there are other means to discipline your child. And we do see people who go overboard with the whoopings. We do see people who go overboard with not whooping their child. But you have to find, as an adult, we have to find alternative means. And we have to use critical thinking because just because your parents did it don't always mean it worked. Because, I mean, look at our conditions.
Yeah, people say, hey, it worked on me. You know, I got whooped. And I was like, I understand that, but, like, did it really work is my question. And it may have and it may not, but I want to make sure I question it first, you know, because I don't think it worked on me. And I think I want to, in my personal life, find alternate means of discipline that aren't fear-based. You know, it's like there's more teaching lessons and talking and communicating. You know.
Right.
I'm interesting. Because and when I say this, people get really confused. I'm not a fan of spanking, but I do spank. And that's just me being honest. I'm not a fan of it. I'm really not.
Yeah.
I try to find alternate ways. You know, my wife's favorite saying is there are plenty of ways to skin a cat, because there are.
Yeah.
But there are certain times with situations, and it's not even with all of the kids, because some kids, and I think that's one thing when you say be critical, it makes a lot of sense, because some kids you do not have to spank. Like, there is no need for it. There really isn't. You can have a conversation with those children, and they will understand from that conversation. Or, like Joe said, getting the spanking for, like, my oldest son, spanking him, it does nothing. He doesn't even feel it. He'll just look at you like you're crazy. So it's no point. But now when you say you can't watch TV for a week, you know, he's in the room on the bed crying. You know, so there. But I do feel what you're saying about being critical about it. You know, it might not be. But, you know, my thing is spanking is one tool on the parental tool belt. And it's not the use in all situations tool. It's the break in case of emergency last resort on the wall, in the glass tool that you use when there's nothing else.
Man.
I tell you though.
Yeah, I think a good example would be if I got whooped when I was younger. We had a dude, you know, in school that failed a few times. He's a little older than we are. He had some condoms. He gave me a condom. Uh-oh. I'm in fourth grade. I don't know what this thing is. You know, so all my parents do is, like, whoop me for it. And I'm like, you know, somebody could have talked to me about that thing. Like,
right.
You need this because, you know, you're not having sex. You know,
exactly. You know, son, why do you have a condom and who gave it to you? Because you didn't leave this house with a condom.
Nothing from that at all.
Yeah.
You know,
condoms get you hit. That's what you learn. Condoms will get you hit.
You learn. Sex is bad. Condoms are bad.
Yeah, right. By the way, I could have grown up to get some STDs because I was
exactly.
Every time he said the condom, he started shaking.
I was
shaking.
Just joking on that one, but yeah.
Yeah, nah, I feel you though. Nah, it's just you making me flashback to some of my whoopings though. So.
Nah, but you making a real good point though, especially for the parents that do just whip their children without ever having a conversation with them, and then because I've had talks with some of them and that. Well, did you tell him why you beat him? He know what he did. Well, how he know?
Yeah.
How you know?
Man, see, it's like I was in my mom's neighborhood, and one of the neighbors, I was down at the neighbor's house, and the neighbor's daughter at the time had a 1-year-old. Now, some genius left the oven open. Now, luckily, the oven wasn't owned, but the baby, being a 1-year-old, crawled into the oven. So the aunt of the baby, instead of, you know, saying, dang, we messed up, she cursed the baby slap out.
Mm.
Like, like the baby owed her some money or something. MF, you dumb beat it. And I'm like,
wow.
And see, that's another form that people don't get too. Sometimes it's not always about you physically putting your hands on somebody, but you can't be cursing your kids out like they're your friends.
You
cannot do that. And I hate when I see parents doing that. I mean, you just want to just jump on them and grab their heads and like, this is a child. You did something wrong. Think about that.
I know, like, think about how much that paralyzes an adult, you know, like, some people can't go through that day, you know, like, man, I just feel really shitty. I got cussed out and treated like crap. And then, you know, like, you imagine that compounding over a kid's life, and they got to go through school and go through life. You've just been beat down forever, physically and emotionally. It's just not good.
Yeah,
right, that's crazy.
I think in a lot of that too, though, we like when you say it makes you think. When you talk about thinking critically, which is something that we need to do a lot of, I'm not a big fan of even punishing your child while you're mad, talking to them or anything. Like,
like
if you're upset, like even with me, like when I'm furious at my kids, I won't talk to them until I calm down. I'll go outside, take a walk, take a drive, go try to do a backwards flip in the grass and laugh because I damn near break my neck. Something to calm down, and then I'll go and deal with the situation once I'm calm. And I think like that's not just with parenting our kids, but just kind of with everything we do. We need to kind of make a point to try and calm down a little bit before we make decisions.
You know,
I mean,
these are
helps.
People we love, you know? Like, we love these people, you know? Like,
yeah, and think about it. Like, when they grow up, they're going to be taking care of you.
Yeah. Hope. You hope they take care of you.
I didn't even think about that one. That's a good point.
Yeah, like when you turn 70, 80, 90 years old and you need to wear one of them Pampers, they're going to be there, and then when they put your old ass in the home, you're going to be mad.
Yeah.
My kids don't love me. And well, hell, look how you, I mean, shit.
Yeah.
You beat on them for 30 years.
I know, and I think from the standpoint, like, you know, especially as a black person, I tell my kid, you know, I think, like, man, the world doesn't want your skin color in it, you know, like, there's enough shit against you. You don't need me against you.
Right,
you know, like,
right. I mean,
you
damn,
need
we
some real
yeah.
support, some real confidence building here, you know.
Yeah, right, home base. They call this home base for a reason. So,
yeah,
I will say, I'm not, like I said, and I guess that's, and it's cool to differ and disagree, but I will say I will whoop my kid ass if they cross certain lines. Like if you cross certain lines, you're going to, as much as I hate beating you, you're going to get it.
Yeah,
but they
yeah.
know what those lines are too, though. It's not like it's a secret. Like, oh shit.
You know? Yeah, so you're like you are open about it. You know, you being up front.
Right.
They know. You know, I told them stealing a car is wrong. So if the police tell me that you just stole somebody's car, you gonna get ass whooping. I mean, you know, we know.
Oh yeah,
because people work hard for their stuff, and we ain't got no time for all that. And I ain't paying for nothing. All right, so it's time for our world famous question. And you, my friend Steven, are our target this week. So we're okay. Gonna set it off like this.
So Mr. Dunn, if you were the all-powerful, all-knowing, all-controlling ruler of Black America, what would you change, and what would your message to the people be?
Whoa, here's a question of the week. If I were all-knowing, okay, my first answer would be to do something to not become all-knowing. Is that escaping the question?
That is an escape.
Okay. All right. If I were all-knowing about what would my message to Black people be, I would definitely say love each other more. Not that we don't love each other, but I think there could be more of that. And yeah, I would definitely say do more to uplift each other.
Yeah.
And definitely learn about finances.
Yes, sir.
We're in this capitalistic country. It is pretty important.
Yeah. I mean, it's, and I'm glad you did say that part, because I don't think we understand how important it is to have a capitalistic mindset. When you're dealing with capitalism, that don't mean you have to be a capitalist 24/7. But when it comes to your money, you need to be a shark.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and I'll still make some bad financial decisions. I'm learning though, but I think. And I know y'all always talk about it, and I really appreciate that aspect.
Yeah, because look. I'm a capitalist in the purest sense of the word, meaning I believe in private ownership.
Yeah.
Now, all of the other stuff that people attach to capitalism, I want no parts of that. But in the purest sense of private ownership, I'm a capitalist, and I'm all about taking full advantage of everything that I own. But I think, you can do that stuff for yourself and for your community. Like, you don't have to be selfishly greedy about it. You can...
Yeah. And I think a lot of our disadvantages lie in old capitalistic practices that's just continued, the redlining with the real estate, sharecropping. Like, we all know about this stuff, and it's all wrapped up in capitalism, and that's where a lot of our disadvantages are. Resources in schools, paid teachers, is all there.
Right.
That's true.
Love
you got to learn.
Together.
Yep. And get your money. Cause we scraping together 2 pennies as a whole, and that ain't fun.
Yeah.
So, Steve, can you tell everybody where they can find you? What's your website? What's your social media links? Your Twitter, your Facebook, your Instagram, whatever. And how can people stay in contact with you?
All right. Oh man, I don't know all this stuff right offhand. My website is stevencdunn.com, and I'm on Facebook. I'm friends with the host, so if y'all look at the host, y'all see some mutual friends. I don't know my handle, what that's called. My Instagram, I just post pictures of trash on my Instagram because I like them. So that's not very interesting for personal information.
stevencdunn.com.
Yeah. So, I like discarded objects and accidental arrangements, so that's what my Instagram is for, is just a gallery. But
that's cool.
Yeah, and I'm on Twitter at SC Dunn Jr. on Twitter.
Okay.
My Instagram is filled with pictures of trash.
And you all make sure you support this brother. He's good at what he does. He's put his time in. He's put the work in, and we can't keep just talking about being united. We got to show our united front. So our studio audience want to show you some love, Steve.
Man, I really appreciate this, man. This is great. This is a conversation, man. We got to talk more.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And any future projects that you have coming up, man, you're welcome back on the train. We, like I say, this is a great conversation. I love what you do, and anything that you have coming up, just contact us, man. We arrange everything, and we'll be here again because you're welcome on the train.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Yes, sir. And we'll speak with you later.
On the
you
East
too.
Coast.
Yes, sir.
All right. Peace.
All right. Yeah, Pat. Yeah, Pat. Yeah, Pat.
Mr. I'm sorry. I thought you was making a beat.
Oh, man. Nah, I was about to start breakdancing.
Oh. You know. Well, we can't see that.
I know. I don't think you really want to. Because I can, like, I've been trying to do the little arm worm thing, but my left arm it don't work right. So.
Oh, I've been trying to do the flares, and I almost broke my shoulder.
You're trying to do the who?
The little flares where they be like spinning on their hands on the ground, kicking their legs out.
Oh yeah, yeah, you tripping. Yeah, you tripping, man. You supposed to do that when you supposed to be 16 with a half cut off shirt before you do that.
I've been trying to do that for the last. Like 5 or 6 years. I know how to start it now. I can get it started. I just can't, because you're supposed to rotate your hips around and kick your legs out front. See
where you went. Let me tell you where you went wrong. See, you're supposed to start off with the Jerry Curl and the headband first. You ain't have that.
No,
that grease up the flow.
You're right. My bad. Well, I'm gonna spend the next couple of weeks growing out my Jerry curl.
Man, you got to go watch Breaking and what's the other hip hop movie?
Finished watching
Crush Groove. Breaking. Yeah.
Well, I ain't seen Crush Groove, but I just finished watching Breaking.
You ain't seen? Hold on. You ain't seen Crush Groove?
Nah, I ain't seen Crush Groove, but I seen Breaking 1 and 2. Hey, y'all, shut up, but y'all get kicked out. Nah, I ain't seen Crush Groove. I got it. I downloaded it. I got it. I just haven't. I haven't got a chance to check it out yet.
Ah, man, Crush Groove, man. I remember just one night staying up late, because you know when you're young and you stay up late, you see all the good movies and the nasty movies too. That's how I learned about Showtime and HBO. But that's where I first saw Crush Groove, and I was like, man. I love hip hop music.
Yeah,
like, I love it, man. Steven C. Dunn.com.
Okay. Yep, that's the dude. Check it out. Good stuff going on.
And I just want to let everybody know, if you go to the Freedom Train Instagram @_FreedomTrain, I will have a picture of myself with my shirt off. So.
Oh, I'm sure that's gonna.
Hey man, watch how many likes we get with that. I'm telling you, man.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
You might even get some donations to feed you.
Hey, see my brother, you are discriminating against me and my thinness, my brother.
No, man, I'm hating because I wish I was thin again. I was getting round.
Man, look. There's something wrong with me. I get hungry when I eat. So, something wrong with me, man.
Yeah, I would agree. But, when was the last time you ate some potted meat, though?
Man, look here, man. I'm tempted to walk down the street to the corner store and just go look at it. Because I know it's in there. But see, the thing about it, at that corner store, it's on the back shelf. In the store, and it's all dusty. Because, you know, one of them hood corner stores, because we down the street from the hood, and it's all dusty. And, you know you're in the hood corner store when you walk in, and it smell like weed and cigarettes and crack. So, oh, yeah, you get it in. See, most people know what I'm talking about, because those are the corner stores where under the cash register with the little glass, they got they have that Mad Dog 2020, they got that Cisco, and then they got a lot of do-rags. Oh, yeah. Oh yes, and the perm kit. Two perm kits left. That's
Got you.
Hey, anybody want to come on a hood safari, just follow me, man. I got you. I got you.
Yeah. So check us out.
When? Next week? Next week, check this out. Now, we have Dr. Bailey, the co-founder and executive and the chief executive officer, Luther Elliott IV, the co-founder, and Sharni Bowens, the chief education specialist. And all those are the directors of Ed Anime Productions. And so, okay. 6:30, hit tomorrow. Next week, I'm going to say it country, next week we got Ed Anime Productions. They are the creators of the Meltrex series. So if you ever see the Meltrex cartoon series and book floating through Facebook, the Ed Anime Productions, they create that. So, I mean, you know what I'm saying? We out here.
No, I like that. Yeah.
Hey, man. And so, remember, go to our website, www.freedomtrainradio.com, to listen to the playback of this show and your favorite shows. Or you can subscribe to iTunes and Google Play to the Freedom Train podcast on iTunes and Google Play. And guess what? The podcast is going to come straight to you. You ain't even got to go looking for it. It's going to come straight to you.
Mm-hmm.
And you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at _FreedomTrain. You like our Freedom Train Facebook page. And we are sponsored by PAX, Inc., which is a black advocacy organization, right? Aimed at a black advocacy organization aimed at developing the black community to its maximum potential through a focus on education and economics with the traits of hard work, honesty, and integrity. There we go. I was getting my words mixed up the first time, but they out. So here we go. Next week, Pat.
Next week.
Two fingers up like a player. Spit them apart, because we out this piece. And so, if y'all like us, we'll see y'all next week. If y'all don't like us, well, guess what? It still don't matter. We still going to be here next week. We'll holler.